Chapter 9. Anderson Spins a Tale. 1. Bobby was getting off the couch slowly, wincing like an old woman. "Bobby," Gardner began.
"Christ, I ache all over," Anderson said. "And I've got to change my... Never mind. How long did I sleep?"
Gardner glanced at his watch. 14 hours, I guess. A little more.
"Bobby, your new book."
"Yeah, hold that until I get back."
She walked slowly across the floor toward the bathroom, unbuttoning the shirt she'd slept in. As she hobbled toward the bathroom, Gardner got a good look. A better one than he wanted, actually, of just how much weight Bobby had lost. This went beyond scrawniness to the point of emaciation. She stopped, as if aware Gardner was looking at her, and without looking around, she said,
"I can explain everything, you know."
"Can you?" Gardner asked.
2. Anderson was in the bathroom a long time, much longer than it should have taken her to use the toilet and change her pad. Gardner was pretty sure that was what she'd gone to do. Her face just had that "I got the curse" look. He listened for the shower, but it wasn't running, and he began to feel uneasy. Bobby had seemed perfectly lucid when she woke up, but did that necessarily mean she was? Gardner began to have uncomfortable visions of Bobby wriggling out the bathroom window and then running off into the woods in nothing but blue jeans, cackling wildly. He put his right hand to the left side of his forehead, where the scar was. His head had started to throb a little. He let another minute or two slip by, and then he got up and walked toward the bathroom, making an effort to step quietly that was not quite unconscious. Visions of Bobby escaping through the bathroom window to avoid explanations had been replaced by one of Bobby serenely cutting her throat with one of Guard's own razor blades to avoid explanations permanently. He decided he would just listen. If he heard normal-sounding movements, he would go on out to the kitchen and put on coffee, maybe scramble a few eggs. If he didn't hear anything... His worries were needless. The bathroom door hadn't latched when she closed it, and other improvements aside, the unlatched doors in the place apparently still had their old way of swinging open. She'd probably have to shim up the whole north side of the house to do that. Maybe that was next week's project, he thought. The door had swung open enough for him to see Bobby standing at the mirror where Gardner had stood himself not long ago. She had her toothbrush in one hand and a tube of toothpaste in the other, but she hadn't uncapped the tube yet. She was looking into the mirror with an intensity that was almost hypnotic. Her lips were pulled back, her teeth bared. She caught movement in the mirror and turned around, making no particular effort to cover her wasted breasts.
"Guard, do my teeth look all right to you?"
Gardner looked at them. They looked to him about as they always had, although he couldn't remember ever having seen quite this much of them. He was reminded of that terrible photo of Karen Carpenter again. "Sure." He kept trying not to look at her stacked ribs, the painful jut of her pelvic bones above the waist of her jeans, which were drooping in spite of a belt cinched so tight it looked like a hobo's length of clothesline.
"I guess so," he smiled cautiously. "Look, Ma, no cavities."
Anderson tried to return Gardner's smile with her lips still pulled back to the gums. The result of this experiment was mildly grotesque. She put a forefinger on a molar and pressed. "What? Does it wiggle when I do that?"
"No.
Not that I can see, anyway. Why?"
"It's just this dream I keep having.
She looked down at herself.
"Get out of here, Guard. I'm in dishabilly."
"Don't worry, Bobby. I wasn't going to jump your bones, mostly because that'd be too close to what I'd really be doing."
"Sorry," he said. "Door was open. I thought you'd gone out."
He closed the door, latching it firmly. Through it, she said clearly,
"I know what you're wondering."
He said nothing, only stood there. But he had a feeling she knew. Knew he was still there. As if she could see through the door.
"You're wondering if I'm losing my mind." No, he said then. No, Bobby, but I'm as sane as you are, Anderson said through the door. I'm so stiff I can hardly walk, and I've got an ace bandage wrapped around my right knee for some reason I can't quite remember, and I'm hungry as a bear, and I know I've lost too much weight. But I am sane, guard. I think you may have times before the day's over when you wonder if you are. The answer is, we both are. Bobby, what's happening here? Gardner asked. It came out in a helpless sort of cry. I want to unwrap the goddamn ace bandage and see what's under it, Anderson said through the door. Feels like I jobbed my knee pretty good, out in the woods probably. Then I want to take a hot shower and put on some clean clothes. While I do that, you can make us some breakfast, and I'll tell you everything.
Will you?
Yes.
Okay, Bobby.
I'm glad to have you here, guard, she said. I had a bad feeling once or twice, like maybe you weren't doing so good.
Gardner felt his vision double, treble, then float away in prisms. He wiped an arm across his face.
No pain, no strain, he said. I'll make some breakfast. Thanks, guard.
He walked away, but he had to walk slow because no matter how often he wiped his eyes, his vision kept trying to break up on him. 3. He stopped just inside the kitchen and went back to the closed bathroom door as a new thought occurred to him. Water was running in there now.
Where's Peter?
What? She called over the drumming shower.
I said, where's Peter? He called, raising his voice. Dead, Bobby called back over the drumming water. I cried, guard, but he was, you know.
Old, Gardner muttered, then remembered and raised his voice again.
It was old age, then?
Yes, Anderson called back over the drumming water. Gardner stood there for just a moment before going back to the kitchen, wondering why he believed Bobby was lying about Peter and how he had died. 4. Guard scrambled eggs and fried bacon on Bobby's grill. He noticed that a microwave oven had been installed over the conventional one since he'd last been here, and there was now track lighting over the main work areas and the kitchen table, where Bobby was in the habit of eating most of her meals, usually with a book in her free hand. He made coffee, strong and black, and was just bringing everything to the table when Bobby came in, wearing a fresh pair of cords and a T-shirt with a picture of a black fly on it and the legend, Maine State Bird. Her wet hair was wrapped in a towel. Anderson surveyed the table. No toast? She asked. Make your own frigging toast, Gardner said amiably. I didn't hitchhike 200 miles to bottle your breakfast. Anderson stared. You did what? Yesterday? In the rain?
Yeah.
What in God's name happened? Muriel said you were doing a reading tour and your last one was June 30th.
You called Muriel?
He was absurdly touched.
When?
Anderson flapped a hand as if it didn't matter. Probably it didn't.
What happened?
She asked again.
Gardner thought about telling her.
Wanted to tell her, he realized, dismayed. Was that what Bobby was for, then? Was Bobby Anderson really no more than the wall he wailed to? He hesitated, wanting to tell her, and didn't. There would be time for that later. Maybe. Later, he said. I want to know what happened here. Breakfast first, Anderson said, and that's an order.
5.
Guard gave Bobby most of the eggs and bacon, and Bobby didn't waste time. She went to them like a woman who hasn't eaten well for a long time. Watching her eat, Gardner remembered a biography of Thomas Edison he had read when he was quite young, no more than 10 or 11. Edison had gone on wild work jags in which idea had followed idea, invention had followed invention. During these spurts, he had ignored wife, children, baths, even food. If his wife hadn't brought him his meals on a tray, the man might literally have starved to death between the light bulb and the phonograph. There had been a picture of him, hands plunged into hair that was wildly awry, as if it had been actually trying to get at the brain beneath hair and skull, the brain, which would not let him rest, and Gardiner remembered thinking that the man looked quite insane. And, he thought, touching the left side of his forehead, Edison had been subject to migraines. Migraines and deep depressions. He saw no sign of depression in Bobby, however. She gobbled eggs, ate 7 or 8 slices of bacon wrapped in a slice of toast slathered with oleo, and swallowed 2 large glasses of orange juice. When she had finished, she uttered a resounding belch. Gross, Bobby. In Portugal, a good belch is considered a compliment to the cook. What do they do after a good lay? Fart? Anderson threw her head back and roared with laughter. The towel fell off her hair, and all at once Guard wanted to take her to bed, bag of bones or not. Smiling a little, Gardiner said, "Okay, it was good. Thanks. Some Sunday I'll make you some swell eggs, Benedict. Now give." Anderson reached behind him and brought down a half-full package of Camels. She lit one and pushed the pack toward Gardiner. "No, thanks. It's the only bad habit I ever succeeded in mostly giving up." But before Bobby was done, Gardiner had smoked 4 of them. 6. "You looked around," Anderson said. "I remember telling you to do that, just barely. And I know you did. You looked like I felt after I found the thing in the woods."
"What thing?"
"If I told you now, you'd think I was crazy. Later on I'll show you, but right now I think we'd better just talk. Tell me what you saw around the place. What changes?" So Gardiner ticked them off. The cellar improvements, the litter of projects, the weird little sun in the water heater, the strange job of customizing on the Tomcat's engine. He hesitated for a moment, thinking of the addition to the shifting diagram, and let that go. He supposed Bobby knew he had seen it anyway. "And somewhere in the middle of all that," he said, "you found time to write another book. A long one. I read the first 40 pages or so while I was waiting for you to wake up, and I think it's good as well as long. The best novel you've ever written, probably. And you've written some good ones." Anderson was nodding, pleased. "Thank you. I think it is, too." She pointed to the last slice of bacon on the platter. "You want that?"
"No."
"Sure?"
"Yes."
She took it and made it gone. "How long did it take you to write it?"
"I'm not completely sure," Anderson said. "Maybe 3 days.
No more than a week, anyway. Did most of it in my sleep."
Guard smiled.
"I'm not joking, you know." Anderson smiled. Gardiner stopped smiling. "My time sense is pretty fucked up," she admitted. "I do know I wasn't working on it the 27th. That's the last day when time, sequential time, seemed completely clear to me. You got here last night, July 4th, and it was done. So, a week, max. But I really don't think it was more than 3 days."
Gardiner gaped.
Anderson looked back calmly, wiping her fingers on a napkin. "Bobby, that's impossible," Gardiner said finally. "If you think so, you missed my typewriter." Gardiner had glanced at Bobby's old machine when he sat down, but that was all. His attention had been riveted immediately by the manuscript. He had seen the old Black Underwood thousands of times. The manuscript, on the other hand, was new. If you'd looked closely, you would have seen the roll of computer paper on the wall behind it, and another of those gadgets behind it. Egg crate, heavy-duty batteries, and all.
"What, these?"
She pushed the cigarettes across to Gardiner, who took one.
"I don't know how it works. But then, I don't really know how any of them work, including the one that's running all the juice in this place."
She smiled at Gardner's expression. "I'm off the central main power tit, Guard. I had them interrupt service. That's how they put it. As if they know damned well you'll want it back before too long. Let's see, 4 days ago. That I do remember. Bobby, there's a gadget like the thing in the water heater and the one behind my typewriter in the junction box out back, only that one's the granddaddy of them all." Anderson laughed, the laugh of a woman in the grip of pleasant reminiscences. "There's 20 or 30 D cells in that one. I think Polly Andrews down at Cooter's Market thinks I've gone nuts. I bought every battery he had in stock, and then I went to Augusta for more. Was that the day I got the dirt for the cellar? She addressed this last to herself, frowning. Then her face cleared. I think so, yeah. The historic battery run of 1988. Hit about 7 different stores, came back with hundreds of batteries, and then I stopped in Albion and got a truckload of loam to sweeten the cellar. I'm almost positive I did both those things the same day.
The troubled frown resurfaced, and for a moment Gardner thought Bobby looked scared and exhausted again. Of course she was still exhausted. Exhaustion of the sort Gardner had seen last night went bone deep. A single night's sleep, no matter how long and deep, wouldn't erase it. And then there was this wild hallucinatory talk. Books written in her sleep, all the AC current in the house being run by D cells, runs to Augusta on crazy errands. Except that the proof was here, all around him. He had seen it.
That one, Anderson said, and laughed. What, Bobby?
I said I had a devil of a job setting up the one that generates the juice here in the house and out at the dig.
What dig? Is it the thing in the woods you want to show me?
Yes. Soon. Just give me a few more minutes.
Anderson's face again assumed that look of pleasure in telling, and Gardner suddenly thought it must be the expression on the faces of all those who have tales they don't just want to tell, but tales they must tell, from the lecture hall bore who was part of an Antarctic expedition in 1937 and who still has his fading slides to prove it, to Ishmael the sailor man, late of the ill-fated Pequod, who finishes his tale with a sentence that seems a desperate cry only thinly and perfunctorily disguised as information. Only I am left to tell you.
Was it desperation and madness that Gardner detected beneath Bobby's cheerful, disjointed remembrances of 10 wacky days in Haven?
Gardner thought so. Knew so. Who was better equipped to see the signs? Whatever Bobby had faced here while Gardner was reading poetry to overweight matrons and their bored husbands, it had nearly broken her mind. Anderson lit another cigarette with a hand that trembled slightly, making the match flame quiver momentarily. It was the sort of thing you would have seen only if you were looking for it.
I was out of egg cartons by then, and the thing was going to have too many batteries for just one or two anyway. So I got one of Uncle Frank's cigar boxes. There must be a dozen old wooden ones up in the attic. Probably even Mabel Noyes down at Junkatorium would pay a few bucks for them, and you know what a skinflint she is. And I stuffed them with toilet paper and tried to make nests in the paper for the batteries to stand up in. You know, nests?
Anderson made quick poking gestures with her right index finger and then looked bright-eyed at Gard to see if he got it. Gardner nodded. That feeling of unreality was stealing back, that feeling of his mind getting ready to seep through the top of his skull and float up to the ceiling. A drunk would fix that, he thought, and the pulse in his head sharpened.
But the batteries kept falling over anyway.
She snuffed her cigarette and immediately lit another one.
They were wild, just wild. I was wild, too. Then I got an idea.
They?
I went down to Chip McCausland's. Down on the dugout road?
Gardner shook his head. He had never been down the dugout road.
Well, he lives out there with this woman. She's his common-law wife, I guess, and about 10 kids. Man, you talk about sluts. The dirt on her neck. Gard, you couldn't wash it off unless you used a jackhammer on it first. I guess he was married before, and doesn't matter. It's just I haven't had anyone to talk to. I mean, they don't talk, not the way a couple of people do, and I keep mixing up the stuff that's not important with the stuff that is.
Anderson's words had started to come out quicker and quicker, until now they were almost tripping over each other.
She's speed rapping, Gardner thought, with some alarm, and pretty soon she's going to start either yelling or crying.
He didn't know which he dreaded more, and thought again of Ishmael. Ishmael rambling through the streets of Bedford, Massachusetts, stinking more of madness than whale oil, finally grabbing some unlucky passerby and screaming, "Listen, I'm the only fucking one left to tell you, and so you better listen, damn you.
You better listen if you don't want to be using this harpoon for a fucking suppository. I got a tale to tell. It's about this white fucking whale, and you're going to listen.
He reached across the table and touched her hand. You tell it any old way you want to. I'm here, and I'm going to listen. We've got time. Like you said, it's your day off, so slow down. If I fall asleep, you'll know you got too far from the point. Okay?
Anderson smiled and relaxed visibly. Gardner wanted to ask again what was going on in the woods. More than that, who they were. But it would be best to wait. All bad things come to him who waits, he thought. And after a pause to collect herself, Bobby went on.
Chip McCausland's got 3 or 4 hen houses. That's all I started to say. For a couple of bucks, I was able to get all the egg cartons I wanted. Even a few of the big egg crate sheets. Those sheets each have 10 dozen cradles.
Anderson laughed cheerfully and added something that brought goose flesh out on Gardner's skin. Haven't used one of those yet. But when I do, I guess we'll have enough zap for the whole town of Haven to let go of the CMP tit, with enough left over for Albion and most of Troy as well. So I got the power going here. Jesus, I'm rambling. And I already had the gadget hooked up to the typewriter, and I really did sleep. Napped, anyway. And that's about where we came in, isn't it?
Gardner nodded, still trying to cope with the idea that there might be fact as well as hallucination in Bobby's casual statement that she could build a gadget which could power 3 small towns from a source consisting of 120 D-cell batteries.
What the gadget on the typewriter does is...
Anderson frowned, her head cocked a little, as if she were listening to a voice Gardner could not hear.
It might be easier to show you. Go on over there and roll in a sheet of paper, would you?
Okay. He headed for the door into the living room, then looked back at Anderson. Aren't you coming?
Bobby smiled.
I'll stay here, she said.
And then Gardner got it.
He got it. And even understood on some mental level where only pure logic was allowed that it might be so. Hadn't the immortal Holmes himself said that when you eliminated the impossible, you had to believe whatever was left, no matter how improbable? And there was a new novel sitting in there on the table by what Bobby sometimes called her word accordion.
Yeah, except typewriters don't write books by themselves, guard old buddy.
You know what the immortal Holmes probably would say? That the fact that there is a novel sitting next to Bobby's typewriter, and the added fact that this is a novel you never saw before does not mean it is a new novel. Holmes would say Bobby wrote that book at some time in the past. Then, while you were gone and Bobby was losing her marbles, she brought it out and set it beside the typewriter. She may believe what she's telling you, but that doesn't make it so.
Gardner walked into the cluttered corner of the living room that served as Bobby's writing quarters. It was handy enough to the bookshelf, so she could simply rock back on the legs of her chair and grab almost anything she wanted.
It's too good to be a trunk novel.
He knew what the immortal Holmes would say about that, too. He would agree that The Buffalo Soldiers being a trunk novel was improbable. He would argue, however, that writing a novel in 3 days, and not at the typewriter, but while taking catnaps between repeated frenzies of activity, was im-fucking-possible.
Except that novel hadn't come out of any trunk. Gardner knew it, because he knew Bobby. Bobby would have been just as incapable of sticking a novel that good in her trunk as Gard was of remaining rational in a discussion on the subject of nuclear power.
Fuck you, Sherlock, and the handsome cab you and Dr. W. rode in on. Christ, I want a drink.
The urge, the need to drink, had come back in full, frightening force.
You there, guard?
Anderson called.
Yes.
This time he consciously saw the roll of computer paper. It hung down loosely. He looked behind the typewriter and did indeed see another of Bobby's gadgets. This one was smaller, half an egg carton, with the last 2 egg cradles standing empty. D cells stood in the other 4, each neatly capped with one of those little funnels. Looking at them more closely, Gard decided they were scraps of tin can, carefully cut to shape with tin snips, each with a wire coming out of the funnel over the positive post. One red, one blue, one yellow, one green. These went to another circuit board. This one, which looked as if it might have come from a radio, was held vertical by two short flat pieces of wood that had been glued to the desk with the board sandwiched in between. Those pieces of wood, each looking a little like the chalk gutter at the foot of a blackboard, were so absurdly familiar to Gardner that for a moment he was unable to identify them. Then it came. They were the tile holders you put your letters on when you were playing Scrabble. One single wire, almost as thick as an AC cord, ran from the circuit board into the typewriter. "Put in some paper," Anderson called. She laughed. "That was the part I almost forgot. Isn't that stupid?" "They were no help there, and I almost went crazy before I saw the answer. I was sitting on the Jakes one day, wishing I'd gotten one of those damn word crunchers after all, and when I reached for the toilet paper, Eureka! Boy, did I feel dumb. Just roll it in, guard." "No, I'm getting out of here right now. And then I'm going to hitch a ride up to the Purple Cow in Hampton and get so fucking drunk I'll never remember this stuff. I don't ever want to know who they are." Instead, he pulled on the roll, slipped the perforated end of the first sheet under the roller, and turned the knob on the side of the old machine until he could snap the bar down. His heart was beating hard and fast. "Okay," he called. "Do you want me to, turn something on?" He didn't see any switch, and even if he had, he wouldn't have wanted to touch it. "Don't need to," she called back. Guard heard a click. It was followed by a hum, the sound of a kid's electric train transformer. Green light began to spill out of Anderson's typewriter. Gardner took an involuntary, shambling step backward on legs that felt like stilts. The light rayed out between the keys in weird, diverging strokes. There were glass panels set into the Underwood's sides, and now they glowed like the walls of an aquarium. Suddenly, the keys of the typewriter began to depress themselves, moving up and down like the keys of a player piano. The carriage moved rapidly, and letters spilled across the page. "Full fathom five, my father lies." Ding, bang, the carriage returned. "No, I'm not seeing this. I don't believe I'm seeing this. These are pearls that were his eyes." Sickly green light spilling up through the keyboard and over the words like radium. Ding, bang. "My beer is Rheingold, the dry beer." The line appeared in the space of a second, it seemed. The keys were a hammering blur of speed. It was like watching a news ticker. "Think of Rheingold whenever you buy beer." Dear God, is she really doing this? Or is it a trick? With his mind tottering again in the face of this new wonder, he found himself grasping eagerly for Sherlock Holmes. A trick! Of course it was a trick. All a part of poor old Bobby's nervous breakdown, her very creative nervous breakdown. Ding, bang! The carriage shot back. "No trick, guard." The carriage returned, and the hammering keys typed this before his wide, staring eyes. "You were right the first time. I'm doing it from the kitchen. The gadget behind the typewriter is thought-sensitive, the way a photoelectric cell is light-sensitive. This thing seems to pick up my thoughts, clearly, up to a distance of 5 miles. If I'm further away than that, things start to get garbled. Beyond 10 or so, it doesn't work at all. Ding, bang." The big silver lever to the left of the carriage worked itself twice, cranking the paper, which now held 3 perfectly typed messages, up a few lines. Then it resumed. "So you see, I didn't have to be sitting at the typewriter to work on my novel. Look, Ma, no hands. This poor old Underwood ran like a bastard for those 2 or 3 days, guard, and all the time it was running, I was in the woods, working around the place or down cellar. But as I say, mostly I was sleeping. It's funny. Even if someone could have convinced me such a gadget existed, I wouldn't have believed it would work for me, because I've always been lousy at dictating. I have to write my own letters, I always said, because I have to see the words on paper. It was impossible for me to imagine how someone could dictate a whole novel into a tape recorder, for instance, although some writers apparently do just that. But this isn't like dictating, Guard. It's like a direct tap into the subconscious, more like dreaming than writing. But what comes out is unlike dreams, which are often surreal and disconnected. This really isn't a typewriter at all anymore. It's a dream machine, one that dreams rationally. There's something cosmically funny about them giving it to me so I could write The Buffalo Soldiers. You're right. It really is the best thing I've ever written. But it's still your basic oat opera. It's like inventing a perpetual motion machine so your little kid won't pester you anymore about changing the batteries in his toy car. But can you imagine what the results might have been if F. Scott Fitzgerald had had one of these gadgets? Or Hemingway? Faulkner? Salinger? After each question mark, the typewriter fell momentarily silent and then burst out with another name. After Salinger's, it stopped completely. Gardner had read the material as it came out, but in a mechanical, almost uncomprehending way. His eyes went back to the beginning of the passage. I was thinking that it was a trick, that she might have hooked the typewriter up somehow to write those two little snatches of verse, and it wrote. It had written, "No trick, Guard." He thought suddenly, "Can you read my mind, Bobby?" Ding, bang. The carriage returned suddenly, making him jump and almost cry out. "Yes, but only a little." What did we do on the 4th of July, the year I quit teaching? Drove up to Derry. You said you knew a guy who'd sell us some cherry bombs. He sold us the cherry bombs, but they were all duds. You were pretty drunk. You wanted to go back and knock his block off. I couldn't talk you out of it, so we went back, and damned if his house wasn't on fire. He had a lot of real stuff in the basement, and he dropped a cigarette butt into a box of it. You saw the fire and the fire trucks, and got laughing so hard you fell down in the street. That feeling of unreality had never been as strong as it was now. He fought it, keeping it at arm's length while his eyes searched through the previous passage for something else. After a second or two, he found it. "There's something almost cosmically funny about them giving it to me, you know?" And earlier Bobby had said, "The batteries kept falling over, and they were wild, just wild." His cheeks felt hotly flushed, as if with fever, but his forehead felt as cold as an ice pack. Even the steady pulse of pain from above his left eye seemed cold, shallow stabs hitting with metronome-like regularity. Looking at the typewriter, which was filled with that somehow ghastly green light, Gardner thought, "Bobby, who are they?" Ding, bang. The keys rattled off a burst, letters forming words, the words forming a child's couplet. "Late last night and the night before, Tommy knockers, knocking at the door." Jim Gardner screamed. 7. At last, his hands stopped shaking, enough so he could get the hot coffee to his mouth without slopping it all over himself, thus finishing the morning's lunatic festivities with a few more burns. Anderson kept watching him from the other side of the kitchen table with concerned eyes. She kept a bottle of very good brandy in the darkest depths of the pantry, far away from the alcoholic staples, and she had offered to spike Guard's coffee with a wallop of it. He had declined, not just with regret, but with real pain. He needed that brandy. It would dull the ache in his head, maybe kill it entirely. More important, it would bring his mind back into focus. It would get rid of that, "I just sailed off the edge of the world" feeling. Only problem was, he'd finally gotten to that point, hadn't he? Correct. The point where it wouldn't stop with a single wallop of brandy in his coffee. There had been entirely too much input since he had opened the hatch at the bottom of Bobby's water heater and then gone upstairs for a belt of whiskey. It had been safe then. Now the air was the unsteady sort that spawned tornadoes. So, no more drinks. Not so much as an Irish sweetener in his coffee, until he understood what was happening here, including what was happening to Bobby. That, most of all. I'm sorry that last bit happened, Anderson said. But I'm not sure I could have stopped it. I told you it was a dream machine. It's also a subconscious machine. I'm really not getting much of your thoughts at all, Guard. I've tried this with other people, and in most cases it's as easy as sinking your thumb into fresh dough. You can core all the way down to what I guess you'd call the id, although it's awful down there, full of the most monstrous. You can't even call them ideas. Images, I guess you'd say. Simple as a child's scrawl, but they're alive. Like those fish they find down deep in the ocean, the ones that explode if you bring them up. Bobby suddenly shuddered. They're alive, she repeated. For a second, there was no sound but the bird singing outside. Anyway, all I get from you is surface stuff, and most of that is all broken up and garbled. If you were like anyone else, I'd know what's been going on with you and why you look so crappy. Thanks, Bobby. I knew there was a reason I keep coming here, and since it's not the cooking, it must be the flattery. He grinned, but it was a nervous grin, and he lit another cigarette. As it is, Bobby went on, as if he hadn't spoken, I can make some educated guesses on the basis of what's happened to you before, but you'd have to tell me the details. I couldn't snoop even if I wanted to. I'm not sure I could get it clear even if you shoved it all up to the front of your mind and put out a welcome mat. But when you asked who they were, that little rhyme about the Tommyknockers came up like a big bubble, and it ran itself off on the typewriter. All right, Gardner said, although it wasn't all right. Nothing was all right. But who are they besides the Tommyknockers? Are they pixies, leprechauns, grim? I asked you to look around because I wanted you to get an idea of how big all of this is, Anderson said. How far-reaching the implications could be. I realize that all right, Gardner said, and a smile ghosted around the corners of his mouth. A few more far-reaching implications, and I'll be ready for a straight waistcoat. Your Tommyknockers came from space, Anderson said, as I think you must have deduced by now. Gardner supposed the thought had done more than cross his mind, but his mouth was dry, his hands frozen around the coffee cup. Are they around? He asked, and his voice seemed to come from far, far away. He was suddenly afraid to turn around, afraid he might see some gnarled thing with three eyes and a horn where its mouth should have been come waltzing out of the pantry, something that belonged only on a movie screen, maybe in a Star Wars epic. I think the actual physical they, have been dead for a long time. Anderson said calmly. They probably died long before men existed on Earth. But then, Caruso's dead, but he's still singing on a hell of a lot of records, isn't he? Bobby, Gardner said, tell me what happened. I want you to begin at the beginning and end by saying, then you came up the road just in time to grab me when I passed out. Can you do that? Not entirely, she said, and grinned. But I'll do my best. 8. Anderson talked for a long time. When she finished, it was past noon. Guard sat across the kitchen table smoking, excusing himself only once to go into the bathroom, where he took 3 more aspirin. Anderson began with her stumble, told of coming back and digging out more of the ship, enough to realize she had found something utterly unique, and then going back a third time. She did not tell Gardner about Chuck the Woodchuck, who had been dead but not flyblown, nor about Peter's shrinking cataract, nor about the visit to Etheridge, the vet. She passed over those things smoothly, saying only that when she came back from her first whole day of work on the thing, she had found Peter dead on the front porch. It was as if he'd gone to sleep, Anderson said, and there was a note of schmaltz in her voice, so unlike the Bobby he knew that Gardner looked up sharply, and then looked down at his hands quickly. Anderson was crying a little. After a few moments, Gardner asked, what then?
Then you came up the road just in time to grab me when I passed out, Anderson said, smiling.
I don't understand what you mean.
Peter died on the 28th of June, Anderson said. She had never had much practice as a liar, but thought this one came out sounding smooth and natural.
That's the last day I remember clearly and sequentially.
Until you showed up last night, that is.
She smiled openly and guilelessly at Gardner, but this was also a lie. Her clear, sequential, unjumbled memories ended the day before, on June 27th, with her standing above that titanic thing buried in the earth, gripping the handle of the shovel. They ended with her whispering, "Everything's fine," and then beginning to dig.
There was more to the tale, all right, all kinds of more, but she couldn't remember it sequentially, and what she could remember would have to be edited, carefully edited. For instance, she couldn't really tell Gard about Peter. Not yet. They had told her she couldn't, but on that one she didn't need any telling. They had also told her Jim Gardner would have to be watched very, very closely. Not for long, of course. Soon Gard would be part of us, on the team. Yes, and it would be great to have him on the team, because if there was anyone in the world Anderson loved, it was Jim Gardner.
Bobby, who are they?
The Tommyknockers.
That word, which had risen out of the queer opaqueness in Gard's mind like a silvery bubble, was as good a name as any, wasn't it?
Sure, better than some.
So, what now? Gardner asked, lighting her last cigarette. He looked both dazed and wary.
I'm not saying I can swallow all this.
He laughed a bit wildly. Or maybe it's just that my throat's not big enough for it all to go down at once.
I understand, Anderson said. I think the main reason I remember so little about the last week or so is that it's all so weird. It's like having your mind strapped to a rocket sled.
She didn't like lying to Gard. It made her uneasy. But all the lying would be done soon enough. Gard would be persuaded.
When he saw the ship. When he felt the ship.
No matter how much I do or don't believe, I'm forced to believe most of it, I guess.
When you remove the impossible, whatever remains is the truth, no matter how improbable.
You got that too, did you?
The shape of it. I might not even have known what it was if I hadn't heard you say it once or twice.
Gardner nodded.
Well, I guess it fits the situation we have here. If I don't believe the evidence of my senses, I have to believe I'm crazy.
Although God knows there are enough people in the world who would be more than happy to testify that's just what I am.
You're not crazy, Gard, Anderson said quietly, and put her hand over his.
He turned his own over and squeezed it.
Well, you know, a man who shot his wife. There are people who'd say that's pretty persuasive evidence of insanity, you know?
Gard, that was 8 years ago.
Sure. And that guy I elbowed in the tit, that was 8 days ago. I also chased a guy down Arberg's hall and across his dining room with an umbrella, did I tell you that? My behavior over the last 5 years has been increasingly self-destructive.
Hi, folks, and welcome once more to the National Self-Pity Hour, Bobby Anderson chirruped brightly.
Tonight's guest is...
I was going to kill myself yesterday morning, Gardner said quietly.
If I hadn't gotten the idea, really strong idea, that you were in trouble, I'd be fish food now.
Anderson looked at him closely. Her hand slowly tightened down on his until it was hurting.
You mean it, don't you? Christ!
Sure. You want to know how bad it's gotten? It seemed like the sanest thing I could do under the circumstances.
Come off it.
I'm serious. Then this idea came, the idea you were in trouble. So I put it off long enough to call you. But you weren't here.
I was probably in the woods, Anderson said. And you came running.
She lifted his hand to her mouth and kissed it gently. If this whole crazy business doesn't mean anything else, at least it means you're still alive, you asshole.
As always, I'm impressed by the almost Gallic range of your compliments, Bobby.
If you ever do it, I'll see it's written on your tombstone, guard, asshole, in letters carved deep enough so they won't wear off for at least a century.
Well, thanks, Gardner said. But you won't have to worry about it for a while, because I still got it.
What?
That feeling that you're in trouble. She tried to look away, tried to take her hand away.
Look at me, Bobby, goddammit.
At last, reluctantly, she did, her lower lip slightly pushed out in that stubborn expression he knew so well. But didn't she also look just the tiniest bit uneasy? He thought so. All of this seems so wonderful. House power from D cells, books that write themselves, God knows what else. So why should I feel that you're in trouble?
I don't know,
she said softly, and got up to do the dishes. 9.
Of course I worked until I damn near dropped, that's one thing, Anderson said.
Her back was to him now, and he had a feeling she liked it that way fine. Dishes rattled in hot, soapy water.
And I didn't just say, aliens from space, ho-hum, cheap, clean electric power and mental telepathy, big deal, you know. My mailman's cheating on his wife. I know about it. I don't want to know about it. Hell, I'm no snoop. But it was just there, guard, right there in the front of his head. Not seeing it would be like not seeing a neon sign 100 feet high. Christ, I've been rocking and reeling.
I see, he said, and thought, she's not telling the truth, at least not all of it, and I don't think she even knows it.
The question remains, what do we do now?
I don't know. She glanced around, saw Gardner's raised eyebrows, and said, did you think I was going to give you the answer in a neat little essay, 500 words or less?
I can't. I've got some ideas, but that's all. Maybe not even very good ones. I suppose the first thing is to take you out so you can
be persuaded.
Have a look at it.
Afterward, well.
Gardner looked at her for a long time. Bobby did not drop her eyes this time. They were open and guileless. But things were wrong here, off note and off key. Things like that note of fake schmaltz in Bobby's voice when she spoke of Peter. Maybe the tears had been real, but that tone, it had been all wrong.
All right, let's go take a look at your ship in the earth.
But let's have lunch first, Anderson said placidly. You're hungry again?
Sure, aren't you?
Christ, no.
Then I'll eat for both of us, Anderson said. And she did.